Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. David, are you there?
How are we doing?
You're there, right?
yeah, it's great. I just finished a long Zoom meeting about better ideas.
The sound department decided
that they wanted to have, we do ensembles weeks every semester, and it's like two straight weeks. We do five shows a day. Now they came up with this idea to put two bands in each ensemble. We multi-track and live stream everything. And they said, oh, yeah, so the bands will show up at 11. Oh, 10. Two bands will show up at 10 of 11. The show will start at 11. I'm like, huh? We have this thing called a sound check that we like to do. And I'm like, oh, my God, no clue.
Like a good sound man, you know?
Then they said, well, it's going to be like festival style. I said, well, you sacrifice quality for quantity, you know?
That is so true. So here's the deal. I'm going to go say this. Welcome to Two Pints in the Corner with Tony Rain and Dinky Dawson. Tony, unfortunately, is not here with us because he's definitely recuperating from illness and stuff. Peter Limbo, usually with me, is in Italy. And what we're going to do is we're sound people. We're talking to David Wentlin. And welcome, David, Two Pints in the Corner.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You started with me many, many years ago, and then you actually came and installed the sound equipment that I have in March 3rd, 1986, at the Channel with Larry Wineless and yourself.
Yeah, that was we used that equipment for quite a while. It was a heck of a system.
Well, I mean, you brought it in. We set it up the way you wanted it and stuff. I didn't bring in the other kinds of mixers. I just brought in mixers that people could, Yamaha stuff that people could use kind of thing, because the most people that came through didn't know what these black knobs did. And as you know, by the we talked with Patrick about the monitor board and all the knobs and everything, and the fun times you can have with that on stage.
But nobody had really seen anything like your sound system.
But it's still got the highest quality. 60 dBm signal to noise for that monitor board was just unbelievable quality. It's all DBX and everything. And it's down at Woods Hole now, down that area, and just with some of the other system that's hanging up. And this is, 2025, and we built that in, 1972, and you built the cabinets? Yeah. Oh, my God. Old age comes, but it does sound good still.
People would come into the club, and the first thing, they look at it, and it's like, oh, we got to change everything. And they want to turn all the knobs and get to all the processing, and I had that thing locked up like in a safe. I'm like, nope, can't do it. We get into a couple of fights here and there, but eventually they turned that thing on and had some good firepower.
Boy, did they ever. A lot of the artists that we've been talking with already, from Charlie Farron to Mike Gerard, really enjoyed the system. And Charlie couldn't believe it. He was like, wow, because a lot of them were coming in with stuff because they'd already got contracts, stampers with different people, that come in there once in a while to bring a system. But once they got used to this system, they were like, oh, we don't have to pay all these people coming in. We'll just let the channel do it. And it sounds real good anyway,
Yeah, Mike and the Fools, man, they had some great shows in there. I mean, they would fill that place up, and that was a party bin. It was hot and sweaty and dark and the channel was an interesting kind of a club. It had this kind of sense of lawlessness. Well, it was deep in the city. It was like over by the Seaport District. That wasn't really the Seaport District at the time. It was just this over the bridge, and like college kids, they went over that bridge into the dark side of the channel. It was kind of going out on the edge.
So what was the the best show that you ever saw there, and also the best show you ever worked there?
Interesting question. I mean, I have some interesting memories, maybe not the best shows. I have a distinct memory of Roy Orbison being on stage and just looking up at him and like, wow, that's Roy Orbison up there. And he was just bringing it. I believe he passed away like the next day or something.
2 days. Sadly. I think it was 2 days after. I think you're right. Yeah.
But yeah, that was a great show. We had Dickie Betts and Greg Allman. That was an excellent show. It was kind of tainted weirdly enough by Dickie. He wasn't going to go on stage until he got his Marlboro cigarettes, because that was in his contract, and we didn't have the Marlboros, and he was like, not going on stage. So we had to run out and get his Marlboros, and then he was okay, and he played. But no, that was a kicking good show. I mean, there was some great shows. I mean, can you? It's hard to say. I mean, there's a lot of great shows there. John Lee Hooker, Johnny Winter, and Room Full of Blues.
Yeah, but
who would want to see that show again? That was kicking.
Again, great reggae.
Some of the reggae acts in there. You know, I mean, Sly and Robbie, Yellow Man, Third World. You know. Steel Pulse, Jimmy Cliff, they would really have a great show. I mean, the crowd would be thumping, and so would your subwoofers.
But the thing with that lot is that the world music by Black Star Liner, Kevin Almadare, him and I are working together on a book about that whole time period in respect for world music in Boston. And most of it's all based on the channel because of King Sonny Arday and because of all the different musicians, Judy Mowat, that came through, you know. As you named them, you know, they were just so different. But out of the channel, out of the channel, you had a few groups that you eventually worked with. Did you pick them up out of the channel days when you were mixing them?
Well, actually, shortly after the channel, I went off with the Everly Brothers for quite some time. They didn't come through the channel.
Dr. John came.
Dr. John. I didn't get that through the channel, but, man, that was a great, great run. I spent at least 5 years with him goofing around. He was something else. And Tony Bennett definitely didn't come through the channel.
No, yeah.
We did the Hell's Angels reunion concert there.
Oh,
it was pretty interesting. I think James Montgomery played it and a couple other acts, but it was an interesting dynamic
in
the club that day. And there was another motorcycle club that showed up. And they were out front. They were all lined up in their motorcycles, gunning the motors. And I was like, okay, this is not going to be good. Nothing happened, but that was some kind of place. It was. I remember one day we were breaking down the gear on stage, and we heard gunshots from the back room. It's like, what the heck is that? Well, I'm not going to go look, you know. And then later we found out that some rats had come up to eat the popcorn, and the bosses were sitting back there shooting at them in the back room. And I was like, okay.
Did you do the nights with the police in there that we did, the Centurion Club?
No.
No, okay.
The police?
Yeah, not the group, the police.
Oh, the police.
The Boston cops. The Centurion, that's when they stole my car and all that deal. Oh. Remember when I called you? That's right, you were at home. I called you at home, and you called your friend in the FBI there, and next thing I know, they've got my car here. It's trashed in Dorchester and destroyed.
I was going to say, you should have looked in the channel itself. That's where people used to make cars disappear for insurance reasons, because the street right next to the channel had no bollards or anything. So people would put a brick on the gas pedal and run the car into the water. The problem was, the last time someone did it, there were so many cars in there that the car just landed on the other cars and didn't sink. Then the cops came over and they had... and had to bring a crane, and they pulled all these cars out of the water, checking the trunks.
That was the time. That's when Johnny Barnes got all his ideas from his books he's been writing and stuff about that kind of stuff. And it's fun because when you start looking back, there was just so much action. But the bottom line is the music, the quality of the place, the scene for every kind of genre you just talked about and stuff.
Crazy. I remember Aerosmith came in one day. They weren't there to play. But as I went back behind the stage towards the dressing room, and the whole band was standing there. I'm like, oh, hi, guys. I can't remember who they were there to see. You know, a couple of them got up on stage and played.
Well, probably Joe Perry Project with Charlie Farron.
Joe did play there,
And he played there. You didn't do the Charlie Watts thing, did you?
No, I didn't do Charlie Watts.
Oh, man, you would have loved that one. I did a bunch of stuff, but some of them I led to, you know, people like you, people like Scott Pullman, Timmy Hines, Timmy Miller, you know, that whole kind of crew, and Dougie Winicky. I'm going to talk with Dougie because we built the Necco Place together. He wired everything for me and what have you, and Dougie was a little operator that you wouldn't think he'd be doing this, that, and the other, but he did. He had a good time doing the new music bands. Oh, that was a trip and a half, but it was worth it because that's what you're doing now in a different era. You're doing those kinds of bands now, but you're educating them with how they should be in the sound, it's so nice to be in the digital world, but it's because of inconvenience. But if you came through the analog world, you gave him the truth. You gave him the sound. Yeah. You gave him the quality. You gave him the feeling. You gave him everything that goes with that equipment. And if you I know you're applying that at Berkeley now. I know you're applying that to them kids because of the positiveness you're getting back on the feedback and stuff.
You got to love what you do. Even though, you know, like at the channel, we'd be doing sometimes 14 bands a night. And I was looking at the list of bands that's on the site there. And it's like, it doesn't really list all the bands because there was a lot of bands. Sometimes it was just the same bands there watching each other. But, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, every single night of the week, we had bands in there. And it was
seven
it was
nights
insane.
A week. And especially with the new music bands when you were talking five bands a day.
Oh yeah, and then we do lunchtime concerts too. We do like four bands at noon, hose the place down, and then do another 7-8 bands at night.
Yeah, that's the channel. it was good.
Yeah, so here's one of my most memorable. I was thinking about this. My most memorable, oddly enough, is a band that I really never heard of and never really liked, and still don't like them, but. Lords of the New Church.
Oh, yeah.
Remember those guys?
I remember them.
Steve Baders and those guys. They came in. They were in another galaxy. I mean, they were definitely on something way stronger than weed and coke. They went, when they hit the stage, the entire band was like totally wobbly, sleepy eyes. And I'm like, how are these guys going to play music? Jesus. So I was stage left at the monitor board, and which is literally right on the stage. And the first song, the bass player comes up and he's spinning around in circles, you know, like he's getting dizzy. And so he's wrapping himself up in his own bass wire. And then he falls into the drum kit, knocks over both overheads and some cymbal stands and falls down on the ground. And he's still playing. You know, it's like this. The crowd's going crazy, you know. And so I go, all right, I got to go out there. And I start untangling them. I unplug the mics. I was like, no way you're going to use these again. You know, the cymbals off of them, you got them untangled, they got up and played. The crowd loved it, you know. It was nuts. But then things got really weird. Later in the show, the guy, Steve Baders, who was the singer, he starts the same, it was like halfway through the show, he starts spinning around, same thing. And he didn't have a wireless mic back then. It was a wired 58, beater. He ties himself up with the cord, and he falls down on the stage. So this is like right in front of me. Like downstage left. And the crowd's going crazy. He's laying there singing. He's all tied up. And this girl jumps up onto the stage. You know, usually someone jumped on the stage. I go out there and escort him off. But, you know, she crawls up and starts pulling his pants down. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to let this one play out.
I figured this was...
So Stiff's laying there singing away. The band's all looking over and laughing. So she gets his undies down and starts giving him the old shabba dabba ding dong, and the crowd's going crazy. It's unbelievable. So I'm sitting there. I'm like, all right. I had my little Instamatic camera in my bag, so I'm gonna, what the heck? I still have the picture somewhere. Poor Steve didn't really have it in him that night, and he wasn't really up to it, and maybe wasn't the right ambiance or something.
Yeah, that's a good story.
Anyway, the woman crawled back down, and the crowd got a round of applause, and Steve pulled up his trousers, untangled himself, and got on with the show. I'll never forget that one. It was like, oh, my God, this place is bizarre.
That was the place to do it.
That's nuts.
Well, that's a good story. That's one of the better ones we've heard for a long time.
Classic.
Thank you.
I didn't really know them. They were like, you know, a kind of punk, you know,
yeah,
thrash band.
Yeah, but then you got
not the best quality.
But then you got really good quality stuff coming through, and like you mentioned earlier, it was just so nice to see '60s bands. Come through in the 80s and actually play as well. Absolutely. As what they did, if not better than they did.
Steppenwolf, and with Steppenwolf, I think, with BTO and the Guess Who.
Yeah.
You know,
all that good stuff.
Like that. I mean, they were great.
Yeah.
Blue Oyster Cult.
Or any more of those stories about the, like, what you just said, because there's got to be one or two of them.
Man, we did so many acts there. It was nuts. And sometimes, at the end of the night, you know, if you do like, you know, 10, 14 bands, the stage was just like a mess.
Yeah.
You know, and all the wires were all tangled up. There was just gear everywhere. People would leave. I had this big area down underneath the, like where the monitor board was. It was all just full of leftover stuff people would leave behind. Sometimes people leave guitars behind. Yeah. Like, okay, whatever. Put it in the box.
Well, I mean, the drums.
Oh, I remember one with Buddy Guy. And he was like a lot younger then. He got on the bar, and he just, with his guitar, he did like the kind of a duck walk all the way around the bar. It was something else.
I love that stuff. But it's like you were there, and then all of a sudden there were celebrities that would be coming in there, and they're hiding in different places in the back room or in the dressing room and this, that, and the other, back of the stage or whatever. And you'd have fun because the artist on the stage was either with them or just friends of theirs or whatever. And you had fun watching this lot go crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the thing about the channel was like, you know, even like when the reggae bands would play there, you know, everybody was smoking out. You know, back in the 80s and stuff, it was like, it was illegal, for one, but there was usually like one cop, and he would stay outside, and the bouncers took care of everything inside, and, you know, whatever happened in there, like, if there was no problem, the bouncers would just bring them out. You know, it wasn't, you know. It was kind of a well-oiled machine. We did so much volume of bands in there. It was mind-boggling.
It is when you start looking at them. I've got all the lists here, and it's just outrageous.
Even Metallica played there, the band Metallica, and they're like one of the biggest bands in the world right now.
Which one?
Metallica.
Oh, boy, they were just a Sunday band, like Red Hot Chili Peppers, remember? And all those metal
James
bands.
James Brown. Yeah. Lobos.
You know. That was the one I was thinking of. No, not just Los Lobos. What was that other band that was like that? You went and did tour with, I think, I believe.
I went out with the band, and I think band was there with Hot Tuna or something. That was good. Yorma and I ended up being friends. You know, spent some late nights together.
Yeah. But that was the time it was fun to do, you see, because you could go and work and have party time with friends from the bands, because The record companies let you do that. Right now, you couldn't even go and talk to another band because, oh, my record company won't let me even go and play with you. Won't even let me say hello. It's too stagnant now. They don't have that camaraderie that used to do, like you're talking about. You know, all the metal bands, the kids that would come in there and play the metal thing in the afternoon. You know, the Striper, the Mass and all that kind of crowd and what have you. Would look up to all the newer stuff coming up, like Metallica and White Lion or whatever it is, and all those groups and what have you. And but they would party with them and have fun. But you saw some crazy stuff, because every night there was some crazy stuff going on. It's just remembering it all.
It was insane. I mean, there and the Paradise, and they did a lot of time at the Paradise too. And like when I put that just your system in there in 78.
Yeah, that's right, 78.
And then I started working. I lived right around the corner, so that was pretty awesome. We did some great bands over there.
Yeah, you had some great people come over to say hello with you guys with Mark Prento and that crowd coming over. And
we closed at 1 o'clock back then, so everybody needed a place to go.
Well, that's the thing we talked about before. You could go to the Channel because it was open till 2 o'clock. Most clubs were open till 12 to 1, depending on what the license has done and whatever. Yeah. And then you get the last hour at the Channel because that you know the top headliner was going to be on at that time and what have you. People would come from the other clubs, the Rat and all that stuff, and they've been to the other clubs and say, oh, that was good, but we can see a better band at night tonight. Coming here. And
I think that you would close the bar at 1 or something.
Yeah.
Leave me a little after 1, and then you could stay kind of as long as you want. So people would buy like a bunch of beers and just hang.
it's true. People would hang till 3 or 4 and stuff sometimes. And then you get people like Mike Smith and the crowd and Sean McNally and all that crowd doing things. They would all go out to because the sun's just coming up. Especially in the summer, they would go to the beach, and then they were all going to the Red Sox game that later that day or whatever, or a Bruins game or a Celtics game. And Sean still goes and does that. He's still running that kind of a thing for all the community he brought up at that time period. And he gets the tickets a lot cheaper than most people can do, and there's nothing added on. You know, he does that kind of stuff, you know. But that's the beauty of the Channel. They've still got a whole crowd that's still hanging out together and what have you, especially on the North Shore. When the new place is open on the North Shore, you see all the Channel people going up there and whatever. And then when we had a 10-year reunion at the old Bradford Ballroom where Larry got married and stuff, Larry Wineless, remember that when he got married in that place?
Yeah, yeah.
And then that was a time, but then we had an event when I was sick with the cancers and stuff, and we put that on there as a reunion. That was packed with all the people because of the Fools, because of Stompers, because of all the individuals that came in and played it that night and stuff. they really got back into the drinking at the Channel. I mean, that bar was drunk damn dry up at that day. You know, it was really amazing.
Some of those local bands, like the Fools, the Stomps, Extreme,
played
there a lot. You know, the Heretics, Opaja, Bim Scala Bim. They all had like really big followings, and they could fill that place up. I remember the Stompers one was my favorite. The Sal Bagley poured a drink on my head once. we had the timing. You know, they would come in as opening act a lot, and I was like, okay, you're already like 20 minutes past when you're supposed to stop. So I went out, I gave them all these warnings, and then I just went out and started unplugging mics and getting ready for the next act, the headliner, and then he turned around and poured a beer on my head.
Typical Sal.
We had a bad relationship for the longest time. It was sometime last year. I saw him somewhere at a festival or something, and I reminded him. He goes, I'm really sorry. I was such an asshole back then. And he goes, Everybody hated me. I did such stupid stuff. So,
oh, my.
We made up.
You made up. Yeah, see, so I tell you who's doing really well out of the channel? Tom Hambridge.
Oh, yeah, Tom.
Tom's got all the blues guys down in Nashville and in the South. And
he's got a pile of Grammys to prove it.
Yeah. Well, I beat him on one thing, though. The first time when Shrine 69 came out, the Fleetwood Mac stuff I got out on Ryko Disc, when Warner Brothers redid it and stuff, that time it went to number one in the blues charts, and who was behind me? But Tom, I went, ooh, Tom, I beat you on that. But that was that was a good live thing from 69 that people really loved because it was a good rendition of Peter. It's like you're getting all the stuff that came back from Larry and that lot and you lot from Russia, remember, with B.B. King and stuff? And then PV amps are pretty good. I mean, they're not bad at all.
I still have that.
Oh, my God, that's a long time.
I can't even lift it anymore. It's so heavy.
You get one of them young punks. Young punks will do it.
The State Department wouldn't let me go because my hair was too long.
That's right.
First band to ever play in Russia. Your gear.
Larry couldn't believe it. Is speaking.
Oh, wait, it was the same system, right? It was the same system as in the channel, right?
No, it was a PV system, and that we put together, and it worked better because it was smaller, and the amplifiers were smaller, and not only that, the other stuff, BB didn't mind having a PV, you know, as long as it was twin oriented, you know, that kind of thing, whatever. And he did a great sound. I mean, Larry just loved every minute of it over there. Larry, he just, yeah. And then I figured it had all come back, and then all of a sudden it had gone. But I mean, it that was the time for all that stuff that you guys got and got it together, you know, and did a good job with it. So I says,
I guess your amp racks were a little big to travel.
Well, you
built big amps, those giant amps in the channel. One day. They had these giant capacitors. They were like the size of a giant beer, can of beer. And one day, one of those things let loose in the club, filled the club with this toxic smell and smoke. It was like, oh, shit. Normally, we would have evacuated, but we opened up all the doors and plugged in a new amp, and we're back in the game.
They just pop fuses. They pop this, that, and the other. And they always get them to come around the corner. Actually in Cambridge to an engineer that just fixed them up for me all the time when they were needed. But they were still they're still functioning today, some of them, because they're down at, like I said, Woods Hole at the center there and whatever. And also Jim's house, the old engineer, he's got them in his workshop, really. He's got a whole bunch around, all these little four and a halfs all over the damn place and stuff. And subwoofers under the bench, and the whole place rocks. I mean, no matter what you do, whatever music he puts on the turntable, it's like it will blow you away and stuff. I'm saying, it still works. It still works.
Yeah,
still
works.
Anyway, David, we should call it and stuff. If you got any more of the ones that you want to sell me, just tell me now and we'll put that up.
Well, my memory isn't as good as it used to be. I mean, now here at Berkeley, I'm like, you know, I did a show earlier today and it's like, what is it, 3 o'clock? I'm ready to go home.
Yeah, well, that's why we're calling it now. We're doing the same thing because we figured it's half an hour for Patrick, half an hour for you. Patrick was funny. Usual stuff with Patrick. He's hilarious when he gets going. But you are too, because you went through a lot of stuff that you've gone through, and it's great memories from you. And
my God!
And I know the missus is going to love hearing all these stuff that you've got brought. I'm sure she's heard it before, but she'll turn around and go, "Oh my God, David! I mean, I didn't know that one." She said, I didn't know that one about that guy on stage having a woo-ah and stuff.
That was something.
All right.
All right. Yeah, I'll get back to you if anything else comes up.
Yeah, we'll chat. We'll chat more and stuff, and we'll probably see you and Maria at this point later on this summer as things go on and what have you.
We'll be at the protest Saturday in the Commons.
Well, that's your style, kiddo. I just don't let Thumper around the corner. Oh boy, what another trip with that one. All right, I'm gonna let you go because I'm sure there's stuff happening at the place and what have you, and it's time to do that. But have a good one, have fun, and
all right, mate.
Thank you very much. This is David Wentland here, and we're signing out on Two Pints in the Corner. Thank you, David.
Signing off. Bye bye.
Bye.